You're listening to the OCD Stories podcast, hosted by me, Stuart Ralph. The OCD Stories is a podcast dedicated to raising awareness and understanding around obsessive compulsive symptoms. I do this through interviewing inspired therapists, psychologists, and people who have experienced OCD. Welcome to the OCD Stories. And welcome to episode 312 of the podcast. And in this one, I got back on Dr. Stephen Phillipson. So if you've been listening to the podcast for a while, you would have heard him on the show before. We've covered many topics and many sort of niche topics. So this is no different. This one is character indictment OCD, as Dr. Phillipson terms it. So in this one, we go into what is character indictment, first of all, the definition of it, the varied emotions behind OCD, confessing as a common compulsion of this theme, a different way to look at the concept or philosophy or idea of being a good or bad person or good or bad people, feeling like you don't deserve nice things, what the brain's trying to achieve with OCD, how we demonstrate to the brain that we are safe, giving examples of character indictment OCD, and much more. So it may seem like a niche topic, but I think it may resonate with a lot of you. And also, Phillipson always covers a lot of general views and ideas of OCD treatment. So I think there's something in here for everyone. And thanks as always to NoCD for supporting the work that I do. NoCD offers affordable, effective, convenient therapy available in the US and outside the US. If you wanted to find out more about their therapy services and whether they take your insurance currently, head over to go.treatmyocd.com/theocdstories, or the link will be in the episode description. And thank you as always to you guys for listening. I deeply appreciate it. And without further ado, here's Dr. Stephen Phillipson.
Welcome back to the show, Steve.
Always a pleasure. It seems like it's been a while, but it's good to see you again.
Yeah, it has been a while, I think. Character indictment OCD, or character indictment. What is character indictment, first of all?
So character indictment is when our brain voice looks at aspects of who we are as human beings, and it judges us in a globally negative way. So character indictment exists for all humans. If I stub my toe, my brain might say, "You clumsy idiot," to me. Once again, we had an episode where we talked about brain voice versus gatekeeper voice. Yep. And this is a perfect example of how the brain will take information about us as people and create some globalized negative qualitative assessment, qualitative conclusion. Quantitative, it means numbers, and qualitative means the qualities of a person, which are judgmental versus, let's say, numeral based on numbers.
Yeah, exactly.
So with OCD, you know, most forms of OCD involve I think almost all forms of OCD involves a threat that gets paired with an emotional distress signal. And it's interesting because, a lot of people think of OCD as the idea that the threat might be harmful. Like if I touch a doorknob, I might catch AIDS and I might die. And we're aware that the threat isn't always based on harm avoidance or harm escape, but it's really more threat avoidance. And what's very interesting under that kind of perspective is, people coined this term neutral obsessions for people who are aware of, let's say, blinking or swallowing or breathing or even floaters or sometimes even a song that can get stuck in one person's head or even a word or a sentence that can get stuck in our head. And you might say, well, where's the harm in that? And that's probably why they called it neutral obsession. But actually, the threat of these neutral obsessions is the element of the distraction within the repetition and out of control nature of these types of obsession. So that's sort of one thing to keep in mind. Now, in with character indictment, the threat is the idea of a person being judged by one's brain. And then there is a need, an emotional desperation to escape that indictment, to escape that judgment. And so that OCD generally has about five different emotional components under the umbrella. Now, for me, I consider OCD an anxiety disorder. And this has become a bit controversial because in our latest Bible of diagnoses, OCD now has taken on a sort of an identity unto itself, separate from the small now cluster of anxiety disorders. But I disagree with that. I think the fundamental foundation of OCD remains an emotional distress and mostly an anxiety distress. So the five different emotional distress signals that anxiety tends to perpetuate, number one is anxiety. Number two is guilt or shame. And I often put those two elements together, guilt and shame. Number three is depression. OCD can spark an emotional response of even just being depressed. And you see that often when people don't engage in rituals. If a person decides that they're no longer going to be victimized by their OCD and they choose a response prevention path, you often hear patients say that they feel very depressed. And the idea is the brain thinks that the patient is going through a crisis. The OCD sufferer is going through a crisis. So if the OCD sufferer chooses to not engage in the escape response to ameliorate or undo the crisis, the brain reacts as if, oh my God, you're conceding to the bad thing being left unattended to, and the brain's natural association to that can be depression. The number four emotional response with OCD can actually be anger, and that anger can be directed at ourselves, and that anger can be directed at others. I look at it like if a person is engaging in elaborate ritualizing in order to kind of clear a thought, or even ritualizing in terms of, let's say, getting one's hands sanitized. You know, here you might be spending 20 minutes at a sink, you open the bathroom door, and next thing you know, someone, you know, shakes your hand, not knowing you have OCD. And so that response can often be anger. Or the emotion of anger can come just naturally as a response to an intrusive thought or some type of environmental intrusion. And the number five emotional response signal can be disgust. And it's interesting under this element, often with contamination OCD. And this is a critical distinction. Many people think, okay, person it touches something they consider to be dirty and they wash their hands. Now, many people with that form of OCD, you would ask and they'd say, well, I am undoing the threat of catching a disease or some type of something that might put me at bodily harm. But there's actually a large subset of people with OCD who experience a disgust reaction, kind of like an ickiness or a grotesqueness to the presence of dirt that shouldn't be there, or even the sensation in terms of a tactile touch of like grease or stickiness, that disgust response can be as compelling to undo as any other kind of emotional response. So now getting back to the specifics of character indictment, and the thing that comes to mind most often for me are people who have pedophile OCD and people who have harm OCD. So classically, when you think of pedophile OCD, I think that you think of someone who has the thought, maybe I'm capable of being attracted to and then harming a child sexually because I may be sexually attracted to children. And with harm OCD, it's often I might just kind of give in to an impulse. People may not be safe around me. I may be capable of pushing someone in front of a train or a bus. And so there's an element of I might act in this, undesirable, threatening way. And then a person feels the distress of that uncertainty, that risk of acting in a way that's harmful either to a child or to another person. And so they often ritualize in a way of avoidance or undoing. So for harm OCD and pedophile OCD, you have an emotional distress that I might act in this way. And there's also a very large percentage of the population that has the distress signal that says, I might have acted in this harmful way. And that's kind of like what we call false memory OCD. Yeah. So those are the two predominant aspects of these spike themes. And there's many, many others that involve this idea about others being at risk because of some element within a person. And that even can go to risks of like offending God or doing something ethically illegal or doing something legally unlawful. But also there's an element with many of these spike themes that involve the idea of, because I even had the thought that a child might be someone I'm attracted to, because I had the thought I might harm a stranger, I might harm a loved one. This thought in and of itself implies something very negative about me as a person. Only a monster could have a thought like this. And so that's where you have this component of character indictment, where the spike theme generates a sense of being inadequate or being some type of a labeled, horrible, very negative type of person for having the thought in and of itself. And so you see this a great deal, and people will engage in as much ritualizing to try to undo the idea of being this horrible person as they will to try to figure out whether or not they're capable of harming a child. So the brain with this form of OCD, the threat here is the indictment to a person's character, the idea that a person's identity and the person's sense of self-esteem is being attacked by the brain's sense of risk. And so the brain is not actually trying to make a conclusion, oh, you're a horrible person, even though those words might be what the brain speaks to of the sufferer. But the brain's saying, you're a horrible person because you had a thought of possibly being sexually attracted to a child. The brain's goal there, as in all subsets of OCD, is to compel the person to seek relief, to seek an escape or an undoing response. So a person with a subset of OCD will often work within their own mind to try to get evidence that they're not a bad person. And unfortunately, all of us humans, whether because we have intrusive thoughts or whether we just have done things as humans that are not necessarily wonderfully above board, we're going to all, have evidence that will justify the idea of being a bad person. Let's see.
So just to jump in there. So
sure.
Yeah, sure. Just to summarize, to make sure I'm understanding, we're not necessarily saying that character indictment is a subset of OCD in and of itself, but more of a way of understanding things like pedophile OCD or harm OCD, of what may be going on within those subtypes.
No, I'm actually saying the first part of what you said, okay. You weren't saying. That is actually what I'm trying to suggest. Okay. I think, there are two elements of OCD, at least, that are very, very tragic. Number one, OCD is probably, in all of my career, the condition with the most shame attached to it. And that goes across the board of all subsets of OCD. So in that regard, if a person, has this excessive need to wash their hands because their brain is telling them they might die of AIDS from a doorknob, most people, the vast majority of people, realize that that thought is irrational, stupid, unreasonable, And so they are very, very hesitant to share, you know, with others, the content of their OCD's theme. And that goes for basically almost every OCD theme. Even a person who has an intrusive thought of being aware of their own swallowing. It's like, how do you explain to a layperson, well, my whole life is turned upside down and disrupted because I'm aware of every time I swallow. And so that's the number one tragedy of the condition. This idea of this pervasive shame for having a condition where a person is being so manipulated and intruded upon by these very bizarre, very unusual thoughts. So that's just a pervasive element with OCD. But yes, within the condition, I'm saying that character indictment can in and of itself be, once again, the threat that a person wants to run from. So with pedophile OCD, where a person says, oh, I may be attracted to children, therefore they may be at risk of me. In that regard, there's not yet necessarily just specifically an element of being a bad person. It's the threat that I might pose a risk to children sexually, or I might pose harm to others. And so the anxiety in that regard is focused on the ritual being to make sure that I am safe in not being a risk to others. And so the focus here, you know, in those elements are proving, or, you know, proving that I'm not a risk to others, or engaging in avoidance so that a person doesn't have the capacity to place others in harm's way. But with character indictment, the focus is, oh, because you had this thought, this means that you're a horrible person. And that person becomes in and of itself compelled to undo that indictment in and of itself. Or the ritualizing in that regard might come from, you know, you see a lot of confessing with character indictment. And the confessing isn't to have a person reassure them that, oh, you haven't harmed anyone, but the confessing is to have other people say, oh, we all have thoughts like that. You know, you're not a bad person. You're just, this is just the way the natural brain works, because they're looking so desperately to escape the idea of the brain's conclusion that for the idea of having these thoughts, that makes them a bad person. So, you know, it's interesting because when I first started working with people in the 80s, the late 80s, who had homosexual OCD, HOCD, you know, there was an element that being gay would be a problem or bad in some way. And because there was a lot of, you know, homophobia still in that era, and at least in the New York area. But in the late in the early 90s and then mid 90s, I saw a transition where a person's brain would still say, maybe you're gay. And the person would respond, well, that wouldn't be a problem. Being gay would be fine. But I really need to know because my girlfriend should know whether she's dating a gay person. And people started developing a very high sort of ethical need to have clarity about who they are. And so in that regard, HOCD and a number of other forms of OCD fit under the umbrella of what's called scrupulosity, the idea of needing to have control to know that you are living an honest life. Because if a person was going to date and they were gay, they would want to date same-sex people. And so the focus wasn't necessarily because, you know, gay would be a problem. It was, I need to have a clear ethical answer before I go ahead and date people, because it would be misleading of me, and therefore me being an imposter, to not have clarity and not have figured out the answer to, am I gay or not? And so once again, the idea of you being an imposter, you know, there's the character indictment, and that becomes the incentive for patients to want to kind of undo that indictment from one's own brain.
Yeah, thanks for explaining that. It makes sense. I guess, something that had been, there is in my head a clear difference. I don't think I could articulate it. I don't know if you can. So you just talked there about moral scrupulosity and character indictment. They feel very similar, but also different. So I guess, how do they differ? character indictment first, because I think when you first brought this up, my brain went, it's moral scrupulosity. But now that we're talking, it does feel like there's a distinction between the two.
Yeah, scrupulosity is a subset of OCD where there is a over-attachment to doing the correct legal, moral, or religious thing. So scrupulosity might be evidenced where a religious person, might pray, and their brain might say, aha, you haven't prayed in a way that is authentic enough. Or, if a person were to, drop a teeny little piece of paper, the brain might say, oh, that's litter, that's sort of against the law. So therefore, that's kind of wrong. So scrupulosity is more of an element of correctness, of religious correctness, moral correctness, or legal correctness. And there's not necessarily, although there often can be a component of, you did that wrong, and therefore, once again, you're a bad person.
Yeah, that's where my mind was going.
Yeah, those two things can marry up, but they are sort of distinctly different because, with a pedophile OCD, there's not necessarily the scrupulosity. So scrupulosity is the over-attachment, the over-investigation to get something correct. So someone who has a thought, maybe I'm sexually attracted to a child, in that regard, they're not trying to figure out whether that's right or wrong. They have a clear compass for themselves to know that being sexually engaged with children, would be a problem. And so once again, there is this distinction of the brain focusing on bad person versus the brain focusing on, are you getting it ethically, legally, and religiously correct?
Yeah.
So I think that it's understandable that you would kind of make that association, Stu, because they often do co-occur. It's very difficult to separate the two out, although they are sort of based on two separate entities. So one thing I wanted to talk about under the theme of character indictment is what really sets people up for character indictment is unfortunately what is almost universally thought of or agreed upon within almost all societies. And that's the idea of all of us having a self that can be judged or that can be self-appraised in a qualitative, conclusive way. So the idea, if someone says, how do you feel about yourself? The brain naturally starts to gather all of the information that it places weight and a greater degree of emphasis on. And it tries to weigh the things within our world that are positive and attributes against things in our world that are detrimental, defective, and problematic. And so why would a famous American poet say something like humans live lives of quiet desperation? And that person, Thoreau, said that because I think he's sort of observing the idea that so many humans, it's so pervasive for humans to walk around silently with a sense of self-dislike or even self-hatred. And so I think, it's so easy for the brain to take the associations of the thought, oh, you're attracted to children, you're a bad person. And then unfortunately, people actually believe in the concept of good or bad people. And so if you believe in that concept, then it sets you up to being more of a victim of the brain's indictment of one's character. And so I actually put out a saying in my choice article that goes, people who believe in the self and people who believe in ghosts will be haunted by both of them. And so the reason for that is because the brain places so much more emphasis on the aspects of our life that are problematic or detrimental or defective than it tends to the aspects of our life that are accomplishments and our attributes. And I've given a lot of thought You know, why would the human brain do that? And I find it almost universal that humans' brains are much more focused, much more emphasized on our deficiencies than our assets. And my guess, and I'm not a cultural anthropologist, but my guess is that as cavemen, and you know, in terms of the length of time this planet's been around, we were cavemen just a little flash ago. I suspect that if we were really good at picking up cave chicks, but not so great at throwing our cave spears at those deer or saber-toothed tigers, that the brain would be like, hey, you know what? You really need to get that spear throwing, you know, mastered, because you're not going to be able to feed the family that you start with that hot cave chick that you're really good at picking up. And so I think that it's really much more of an adaptation of survival within our programming as humans, that the brain, just as we achieve one accomplishment, says, yeah, but this area is still in deficiency. You really need to focus in on that. You really need to improve that. And so, you know, in the world of cognitive behavioral therapy, there is a alternative perspective offered. And that's kind of parallel to some Eastern thought that would be called no self. And so in cognitive therapy, the idea of self-esteem in and of itself is considered irrational. Because how can we as humans take all of the qualities that make us up as humans, you know, all 148,000 variables that make up each of us, put them all together on a scale and say, okay, we're good or bad? And what happens generally, because we tend to, you know, have a brain that likes to do things a lot more simple than that, our brain looks at a few of our attributes, a few of our deficiencies, and says, these deficiencies weigh a hell of a lot more than the attributes. Therefore, you're not going to really necessarily like yourself, nor are you going to label yourself a good person. And so the antidote is to really, and this is just kind of getting into the very basics of cognitive therapy, which I practice and live by for the past 30 years. And that's the idea of accepting us as just humans. So my brain, although if I stub my toe, might still say, you're a clumsy idiot. Steve, the gatekeeper, responds immediately and is just like, hey, I'm human. Humans stub their toes. And that's the end of it. And so with people with character indictment OCD, because they live life authentically, pervasively, with a sense of low self-esteem, the brain attacking one's own sense of character makes it a very easy target for a person to authentically work really hard to extricate themselves from that conclusion. And that's sort of another, you know, kind of one of these tragedies within OCD, is in this type of OCD, you know, it's such an easy target, you know, for the brain to say, you know, it's funny, everyone who has OCD, you know, when they're in my groups and they hear other themes of OCD, they always say the exact same thing. And every one of them says it. And they say, what do you think, Stu?
Yeah, I wish I had your theme. It would be so much easier.
Yeah. I wish I had your theme. It would be so much easier. You said it exactly as I hear every week in my groups. And the thing is that, you know, obviously that's a complete fallacy, because the theme, the torment of OCD is delivered because of the malfunctioning emotional system. It's not because of the topic in and of itself. So what people often don't realize is that you can just change the theme. And many people with OCD's themes are changed. I'm sure, you know, being afraid of being in a bathtub because you might get eaten by a shark is just as challenging to you as the idea that, you know, that, and I'm not talking about you specifically, that if you might say, oh, maybe my brain says, oh, maybe I'm gay.
Yeah.
That, you know, everyone would want to have, you know, shark bite in a bathtub OCD, because they would look at it and be like, that's the most ridiculous thing they've ever heard.
Yeah.
But they don't realize that it's the emotional infusion of distress that really empowers it. And so with character indictment, here you have, you know, the brain, you know, it's sort of prompting, you know, the idea of being a bad person because you've had these themes or because you have this characteristic. And the person, unfortunately, believing that predominantly, you know, for the most part, genuinely speaking, separate from OCD. And unfortunately, these two things can pair up and make it a bit more of a difficult, kind of remedy. Now, even if Joe, let's say Joe was a cognitive therapy genius and Joe didn't have, a sense of low self-esteem authentically, I would bet you that, character indictment OCD would still attack in terms of creating the association of being a negative person. But Joe might find it just slightly easier to manage, but he just wouldn't have the idea of, the authenticity of it. So therefore, we might look at it more what we call ego dystonic, meaning the person doesn't actually team up with or endorse the theme of their OCD. Were you going to ask something, Kirsten?
No, I was just going to say, yeah, when we were talking about themes there and people were saying, I wish I had that theme, it'd be so much easier. And you're saying it's not really about the themes. How I kind of say that to my clients, I say where the amygdala lives, that part of the brain doesn't understand language. So you can't reason with it. Which is why the themes are irrelevant. It's the creature, so to speak, behind the theme is what we need to tackle. Whether it's sharks in a bathtub or worrying about your religion or your sexuality, it's that same engine. And that's the issue. It's not the content.
That's right. It's interesting. Many, many people with character indictment, their brains will... come at them, their brains will remind them of their undeserving nature. And so I have a patient whose spike is about that he might have gotten two women pregnant. In his spike world, remember, he did actually block them on Facebook, and his brain told him that his two children are starving because he hasn't been paying child support for them. Now, mind you, he has seen some of their pictures. None of these two women, are walking around with their children. But according to his brain, they're starving on a street corner because he didn't sustain contact and offer child support for children that probably in the non-OCD world were never born in the first place. But so this person is a real fan of expensive watches. And when he puts on one of his watches, his brain says, you don't deserve that. Because within his character indictment, he's a horrible, loathsome person that abandoned his two children. And he's the lowest of the low. And so anything good that happens in his life, anything that he might be enjoying of, his brain immediately associates, you don't deserve this. And this is also a very, very common aspect of character indictment, is the chronic reminder of undeservingness. And so in this regard, I often have patients do exposure therapy where they purposefully and voluntarily bring up the reminder of their undeservingness. So when he puts on his expensive watch every morning, he says, yeah, I'm putting on my Rolex and I'm a horrible person. I don't deserve it. But you know what? I'm just choosing this anyway. So in that regard, I have people, before they start any activity that conveys a sense of fruitfulness in their life path, I'll have them voluntarily conjure up their brain's indictment before their brain hits them with it, to show their brain the irrelevance of that signal.
Yeah, that's interesting. That actually came up on a story episode I did recently, where the young lady was saying how she needed a new car, and her brain was basically saying, you don't deserve it, you're a bad person, or I don't know if it's a bad person, but it's along those lines. And
yeah exactly. And that's why I wanted to speak today about this character indictment theme, because it is so pervasive, both as a succinct and distinct theme within OCD, but also pervasive just for having OCD in the first place. Mm. Many, many people, when they join the groups at the center, One of the first things they say is they've never once spoken to another person with OCD. And these are not teenagers. These are 40-year-old adults. And it's so, you know, telling and tragic that the condition, even now, is so, you know, kept under wraps because of this element of shame. And that is separate from character indictment OCD, but, you know, it is something within the condition that I think needs to be, you know, kind of shed light on. You know, it's interesting because, you know, of all the themes, the one that I might actually agree might be slightly worse than the others might be POCD. You know, I think that's one theme. That and HOCD, you know, with POCD, you know, for people to hear someone say, oh, I have thoughts that I'm sexually attracted to children, you know, today's society in our cancer culture, in our cancel culture, you know, could really, you know, be easily misunderstood.
Yeah.
I've had patients disclose themes like that to mental health professionals, to medical professionals. And I've had them temporarily had their own children taken away. I've had patients who have had POCD in marital disputes have custody denied or need to have supervision during custody. So in that regard, you know, it is still societally pervasively, I think, misunderstood. And even something like homosexual OCD, I think almost the opposite, that society wants to embrace the, hey, we accept homosexuality now. Homosexuality is just a very natural, wonderful thing. Come here, let me give you a hug. That people who might share HOCD, you know, are going to have people respond in a way that's just like, oh, I think it's so wonderful that you're coming out, as opposed to, oh, yeah, that is a subset of OCD, just like the thoughts that I have of jumping off of a balcony. And this is just natural human activity.
Yeah.
So in that regard, there are certain themes that I think can be in the world of sharing, particularly with the lay population.
Yeah, they have nuances, you know, to them. Absolutely. Yeah. I will say, though, just to reassure anyone listening, like, yeah, those are all very valid examples about the POCD. But still, in my experience, most people don't have an issue when they've shared that with certain people. You know, I guess what you're saying is there's still the risk that for a small minority, it could happen.
Yeah. I wish I could say small minority. Okay. Maybe in your experience, small minority.
Maybe it's an American thing.
Maybe. I think it's still the pervasive ignorance that goes along with people who are not specialized to really not recognize the condition.
I guess I'm more thinking about when people
share with them. Oh, you were sharing with professionals.
Well, with family, I'm thinking of.
Oh, I see.
And usually the family are like, you're nuts. Like, you're absolutely fine. What are you on about? Like, they see right through it. But yeah, I get what you're saying with professionals. Yeah. But that goes with any type of OCD, right? If you share you're worried about harming someone to some professionals, then we're like shocked by it, you know?
Yeah, I think so. I think with harm OCD.
And suicidal OCD.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's more common that as humans, you know, if we're around a knife, you know, we think stab someone. If we're holding a baby, I think it's very common. Our brain will say, you know, chuck it to the ground. I think those are very, very natural human associations. So I think when people do share harm OCD, I think there would be more of a likelihood that it would be received in kind of more of an understanding kind of way.
Yeah,
I want to just make another point in terms of what I think of as once again the nature of OCD. One of the things that you know, people are extremely, I think, disrupted by and distressed about is the idea of why would my own brain, you know, attack me like this? You know, why would my own brain disrupt my life and make my life so miserable? You know, even the idea of character indictment here with the brain is saying, you know, oh, you abandoned these kids. You're a horrible, loathsome scum. You don't deserve anything good in your life. Why would the brain do that? And I think what it is that the brain is not really trying to, infuse negativity in a person's life. I think because, as you were saying before, because the amygdala is saying, I'm having a crisis. And then it infuses that emotional distress signal with these really stupid topics. You know, that's one of the things that I enjoy about my career is that I get to have some really great laughs with people about the stupid creativity of their brain's topics. And you and your shark themes has certainly been a big part of that. But you can imagine, the brain is coming up with these ideas with the idea that you need to be alerted to a crisis that you now need to exert energy to undo. And so it's not really the brain, screwing with a person and making their life miserable. It's really more the brain saying, I'm having a crisis, you're about to die. You need to do something to find safety or to avoid these dangers. And I think it's really important for people to keep in mind that their brain isn't trying to be an abusive, intrusive, entity in them living a happier life. It's just really trying to clear the way. One of the common phenomena is, a person goes away on vacation. And they lay down on a nice chair on a nice sunny beach, and their brain says, maybe you left the toaster on. Now, they just want to enjoy their pina colada. They don't want to be now disrupted and distracted by the idea that maybe their toaster is on and maybe their house is going to burn down. But once again, here the brain is saying, okay, you get to enjoy this magnificent view, this magnificent scenery and location, but you just need to kind of tick the box that says you don't have to worry about your toaster. And so the brain is just always looking for anything that might disrupt our ability to have a smooth life path. If I lay down to go to sleep, my brain starts sending me every little thing. Did you set the alarm? Are all the windows closed? And I don't get up and check, by the way. I'm just like, yeah, I'm willing to have a burglar come in and rob the house tonight. But, it's like, why would the brain, just as I'm trying to relax, tick off, did you pay the gardener? All of these little things, the brain's like, before you can really go to sleep, I just want to make sure your life is clear. And so even my brain, and I don't have OCD, once again, has this exact tendency. But with OCD themes, it's a lot easier for the brain to kind of pick on the themes and say, well, have these things been cleared? And are you now functioning in your safe, non-disrupted life path?
Yeah, I agree. And I think that's why it's always useful for me anyway, to always bring it back to evolution. And you think about, you're in that cave, you're doing all the checks. Am I safe?
Exactly. Is the fire still alive? You're going in a cave and you hear a twig snap, and your brain says, is that a bear that's about to eat you? Or is that a deer that you could throw your great spear at and turn into dinner? And so the brain turns on the signal and says, okay, this could be a crisis or this could be an asset. And these are just, as you were saying, very natural, biological things from our early programming.
Yeah, and our brain has not evolved quick enough, so we're still in that now, in that programming. But regardless of what the news says, it's a much safer time for most people,
I'm so happy to hear you say that. That could start me on a 3-hour rant about the news's agenda to frighten everyone. But no, statistically speaking, this is a much safer world now than it's been for a long, long time. So absolutely. I'm glad that you agree with that.
But yeah, but that being said, our brain hasn't got that memo, because the part of the brain that keeps us alive is more primitive and doesn't understand cognition. So we can't rationalize with it, which is why behavior therapy works, because we have to show that part of our brain that we're safe. Well, most likely safe.
It's a demonstration rather than a rational dialogue. And so through the repetitiveness of that demonstration, for the person to say, as he's putting on his Rolex and as he's driving in his BMW, I'm a horrible person. I don't deserve any of this. Thanks for sharing, brain. That's a very physical demonstration of irrelevance, and repetitiousness of irrelevant signals turns the brain's disruptive signals off. So, exactly, well put.
Yeah, thank you. So what would be useful for me, and I think the listeners, is there any more examples you can give? So you gave the guy with the Rolex, and when I say examples, not just what was bothering them, but how you worked with them using ARP to show irrelevance?
Well, for some people with character indictment, that might actually involve doing exposure therapy by telling white lies. That fits in kind of with the scrupulosity part of it. But, you know, I think that just kind of going over the evidence. So I'm working with someone who, let's just say her freshman year of college, she enjoyed a lot of it and in ways that were slightly not above board, we'll say, you know, that she let's just say she had a great time and thank goodness, you know, that there's no documentation of it. But now her brain is revisiting some of these fun times in college and saying, these things are evidence that you're a horrible, horrible person. So in that regard, she can, or, you know, one of the things that I developed in terms of treating the pure O form of OCD is the idea of using index cards. At that time, Edna Foa was using for pure O what are called loop tapes. She would have patients, you know, kind of speak out the nature of the spike, have them carry around a little audio tape and have them listen to themselves speaking about the spike themes. And I think that's completely a reasonable exposure method. The reason that I went in a bit of a different direction, I'm not saying better, is because I wanted a person to have more of an active behavioral component rather than a passive receiving component of listening to their own voice. A lot of patients would say that when they would do that, they actually stopped hearing the tape.
Zone out. They
become so habituated to it. And so what I have patients do is I'll have a person carry a little index card on them that actually spells out their brain sense of their crime. And then also it would spell out not only their crime, but then the character indictment to say, let's say it was in college and they were having a fun time with a person on a date. And that person A was with person B, and person B, let's say, had a little too much to drink, and person B was kind of in and out of consciousness, and let's say person A kissed that person. Most people wouldn't say that that's a horrible crime, but let's say that this person now develops an OCD sense of that they committed date rape because they kissed someone while they were sort of slightly unconscious. And so in that regard, they would carry an index card that says, you know, oh, I kissed that person when they weren't even aware of it. That's clearly date rape. I'm a horrible person. I belong in jail. I should go turn myself into the police, or I should ask mom for the 10,000th time whether or not what I did was unethical and deserving of confession. And so I have people carry around these index cards on their person, all day long, first thing they want to pack with them when they wake up. And I have them expose themselves to these index cards 10 times and read them, not in a rote kind of textbook way, but actually read them in a way that replicates the theatrics of how their brain is speaking to them. So to say, I kissed someone while they were in and out of consciousness, that's criminal. That's date rape. I belong in prison. And so in that regard, they're voluntarily infusing and replicating the brain's energy. And in doing that, it's showing the brain once again, not telling the brain, hey, anyone would do that, it's not a big deal. That would be reassurance. But in this regard, it's replicating the brain signal, showing the brain the irrelevance of that signal, doing it 10 times a day. And then I have people kind of just track number one, the amount of anxiety that's associated with it. Number two, how much ritualizing they may be doing with it. And number three, and it's an article I'm about to kind of complete, the amount of resentment they have toward their brain for even bringing up the topic in the first place. And I'm not going to get into it, but I postulate that resentment for the brain's activity can be as much of a reinforcer for the brain to go back and review as even doing a ritual. So that's definitely one very specific mechanism that I really generally recommend for patients to demonstrate in a very physical way that their brain's material is irrelevant.
Yeah, thank you for sharing. I like the index card idea. You shared that before, but I think the new bit you didn't share before was the reading it in the emotion of the voice of the brain voice or the automatic voice. And I guess what came out for me is I know that sometimes there's different schools of thought, right? Some therapists will teach like, no, it's more about, you know, maybe keeping them in the uncertainty. And it's not they disagree with what you're saying. It's they may feel, and I've definitely had clients who struggle to go that extra step of completely almost agreeing with it, but you're agreeing with it tongue in cheek. You're doing it
You're agreeing with it tongue in cheek. That's exactly correct.
Yeah.
And my list too, I don't have a favorite in terms of like, did I molest that person on the plane, when I reached for my food? One might say, I definitely molested that person. And then another person might say, maybe I molested that person. I don't really see that much of a difference. And really, you know, people ask me, well, how do I do this index card? And I'm like, your brain designs it. We don't have to be creative here because your brain is the one that's sending you the signal. So all you're doing is lifting your brain material and just writing it down exactly in verbatim as your brain is sharing it. So if the brain says, maybe you did X, then that's what would be on the index card. If the brain says you definitely did X, then, you know, that's what would be on the index card too. When I get on a plane, and not so much in the past few years, but my brain would always tell me, this is the plane that's going to crash. And there would always be some type of a sign from the universe that says, oh, that plane number flight that you're on, that's the unlucky one. You need to take a different flight. Otherwise, you're going to die in this plane crash. And I mean, I don't have OCD and I don't have a panic about dying in a plane crash, but I would get a little bit uncomfortable about that idea. And during takeoffs and landings, my brain would be like, this is the end of your life now. And I would basically just say, okay, I'm going to die now. I'm making room for that conclusion. And rather than saying, you know, I might die, which once again, I think this is equally potent. Yes, this might be the plane that's going to crash. I just say to my brain, yeah, this is the plane that's going to crash. It's been a great life, ready to die. Thanks for sharing. I guess I'm going to die today. So that's the one that I choose, but I don't see it in any way as being better or worse than the uncertainty part of it.
Okay, well, that's good to know then. But I guess I'll continue with the question anyway, because it's good to know that's where you sit. But because some people do have real resistance to this idea of like in any way agreeing with the thoughts, even if it's tongue in cheek, right? Because, and I think this links back to the topic of today's episode, character indictment of, I don't want to write that down because then I'm admitting that in fact I am a terrible person. So do you kind of just take a different approach and keep them in the maybe zone, or do you like
say, going back to cognitive therapy, if a person is a good student of cognitive therapy, then they would know that being called a horrible person is irrational because and we don't use rational therapy to treat OCD, obviously. So I just make that really, really clear that using cognitive therapy to alleviate low self-esteem or depression is a beautiful therapy. OCD, you cannot use cognitive therapy with OCD because, as you said beautifully, the amygdala has no cognitive capability. So you're using behavior therapy on the amygdala and in terms of replicating the brain signal. And so we're not really trying to instill a deeper sense of belief in being a horrible person. And you said it beautifully in terms of like, it's just a tongue-in-cheek reference. So if you say, you know, Steve, you have an ugly nose, my response would be, yes, I have the ugliest nose on this planet. Plastic surgeons have lined up around the world in order to be able to kind of fix my nose. It's that ugly. Yeah. So in that regard, you know, my response obviously is not saying, oh, I feel so bad about my ugly nose. My mommy says it's not so bad. That response is not going to kind of undo the indictment. But to agree with it in that tongue-in-cheek way is a very powerful mechanism to say to the brain, this just isn't that important to me. I'm not going to give it relevance.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, in terms of alternatives, at this moment, I'm at a little bit of a loss of what might be an alternative. If your brain says, you know, oh, maybe you molested that child, obviously, other than saying, yeah, okay, I molested a child, I'm a horrible person, I don't see an alternative that wouldn't sound like reassurance.
Keep them in the maybes, maybe.
Oh, like, maybe. Oh, I see.
Yeah, okay, like maybe I did, maybe I didn't.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. I mean, sure, I've got no problem.
No, I just wanted to throw that because I know some people are so hesitant to it.
Yeah,
the full tilt. The other thing I'll say with the taking your approach of going, leaning into it and being tongue in cheek is I say to people, you're not, I think of the brain in two parts. And this comes from a trauma training I did. And that bottom part is where the amygdala lives without cognition. And it really, it's your top part, that tongue in cheek. You're not saying to yourself that you're agreeing it or that you're a bad person. You're saying it to a part of your brain. So right. I think that makes it easier when you're talking to a part of your brain as opposed to yourself.
Right.
It's easier to separate it.
A demonstration to the amygdala through a non-resisting, non-reassurance-seeking path. You're saying to the amygdala, you know, thanks for sharing, but I'm not going to do anything with this. I'm just going to respond with irrelevance.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's kind of funny because ultimately, any therapeutic response, the actual words can actually be seen as, entirely irrelevant. One patient who had HOCD, gay OCD, and who was a perfectionist, and those two things almost always come hand in hand for some reason. So he did great with the therapy. And toward the end, he became very overly focused on, am I getting the therapy correct? And that then became his obsession. What's the best way to respond to my brain when it says, oh, you think that guy is hot, that means you're gay. And so he came up with this nonsense word. The word that he came up with was Ishkadidi. I might have mentioned that I think one of my articles. And the brilliance of Ishkadidi is that it means so much of nothing. That what better way to say to the brain, you're that irrelevant that my response to the signal is not going to be given any creative relevance. I'm not going to put any effort into solving a great response to the spike because the spike is what I'm determining to be completely meaningless. And so Ishkadidi, for him, became his final therapeutic response set. I have a nameplate. We call it a license plate here. You know what the identification on your car?
Number plate. Yeah.
So my number plate is a personalized one. And, on my car, it says WATT new word, EVAH, whatever, which is a New York way of saying whatever, which is, you know, a wonderful way of just being dismissive. So if the brain says, maybe you molested that child, and my response is, yeah, whatever, that can be a very, very powerful response.
Yeah. Yeah, I like that. And that's different to maybe, and that's also different to kind of tongue-in-cheek agreeing with it. It's completely dismissing the content.
Well, I see it not as different. I see it as just on a continuum of dismissiveness.
Okay.
I tell patients as they kind of grow in their therapeutic strength and their own therapeutic expertise, you know, that ultimately the least response becomes the best response. You don't really have to engineer a very creative response to an OCD brain to show it irrelevance. And the more efficient you get, the more skilled you get at demonstrating irrelevance, you know, the shortest response can even be, okay, you know, that can be a really, really powerful way of saying to the brain, nope, just not going to play with this toy.
Yeah. Yeah. I like that. Yeah. 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 No, that's awesome. Yeah. Cause the longer you make the response and the more wordy it becomes, you start to get lost in it. And then you're kind of getting lost in all of OCD's words and yeah. Okay. So, I guess, is there anything else you wanted to say on this theme?
I think with all the notes that I had written down, I think I covered them all.
Well, I really enjoyed this one. And it's come up a lot recently. So I think it's going to resonate with people. And I guess if they're listening up to this point, it has done. So that's
cool. what number is this, Stu?
This will be like close to 315.
315?
Yeah.
Wow, that's terrific. I'll just take a second and say, you know, what you've been giving to the OCD community is tremendous. I value what you've given, freely. And so many people look at you as the celebrity. And I think it's deserved. I think that you do this as well as anyone I've ever encountered.
Thank you. No, I appreciate it. Well, I wanted to be a basketball player, so this is maybe the second best celebrity. So I'll take that. Thanks.
I knew you would never be a swimmer. That's for sure.
Yeah, well, not an open ocean swimmer. That's for sure.
You're a bathtub swimmer.
Although, for anyone listening, I am actually doing freshwater swimming now as a way of exposing myself. So, but no, thanks, Steve, for covering this topic. I appreciate it.
Always a pleasure. Always a pleasure. I look forward to our meeting at some point in the future.
Thank you for listening to this week's podcast. If you enjoy the OCD Stories podcast and would like to support us with a one-time tip/donation, please go to theocdstories.com/support. All tips, no matter how large or small, are greatly appreciated. Please subscribe and rate the show wherever you listen to the podcast. And thank you to NoCD for supporting our work. And if you want to find out more about NoCD, head to go.treatmyocd.com/theocdstories or click the link in the episode description. And quick disclaimer, guys, this podcast is not therapy. It is not a replacement for therapy. Please seek treatment from a trained professional. And until we speak, take care.